Coming up on Simply Superior.
Deep in these woods, we find a shack, all wrapped in tar paper. It's hot outside, but the shack looks cold and empty.
New York Times bestselling author and illustrator Eliza Wheeler has a new children's book out, Home in the Woods. And those woods might be familiar to you. Then,
happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Isabel.
Okay, she isn't celebrating a milestone birthday like 21 or 30 or 65, but when it's 102, it's an achievement worth noting. We'll share festivities and memories with Isabel Tucson.
As long as you keep your mind going, you're all right.
Born in Superior in 1917 and still going strong. Those stories and the weekly roundup of regional news after this. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. So what was Superior like 100 years ago?
Thursday night, that's when everybody came out. You couldn't find a parking spot on Tower Avenue.
Isabel Tucson was there. We'll hear more of her story later in the show. But first, deep in the woods, a little further down the road from Superior.
Deep in these woods, we find a shack, all wrapped in tar paper. It's hot outside, but the shack looks cold and empty, like I feel inside. You never know what treasures we'll find, says Mum. In the shack, we don't see any treasures. Wooden table, empty crates, rusty oven, dusty shelf, potbelly stove, box springs. But Lowell and Eva find a door in the floor. Below is a root cellar filled with old glass jars, a tin pail, a pile of rags, and a pitcher pump that goes up and down, and out comes a stream of cool, clear water. This place will do fine, says my big brother Ray, but it doesn't seem like much of a home to me.
That's Eliza Wheeler, reading an excerpt from her new book, Home in the Woods. If that gurgling brook or the wind through the trees sound familiar, they should, because the story is about Eliza's grandmother growing up in the woods of Douglas County. Wheeler grew up in Solon Springs, the daughter of Gary and Jean Swanson, and via Los Angeles now lives in Minneapolis. She's an accomplished illustrator and made the New York Times bestseller list with Miss Maple Seeds, her first book as an author-illustrator. My colleague Al Ross caught up with her recently, shortly after Home in the Woods was named the number one children's book by the Midwest Independent Booksellers Association.
Eliza Wheeler is the author and illustrator, and the newest book is Home in the Woods. She's from West and Northwest Wisconsin, folks, born and raised in Solon Springs. When one reads your bio, it's almost a whiplash moment when one sees the quote, "She is from northern Wisconsin, Los Angeles, and now lives in Minneapolis." I mean, that is a Dagwood sandwich, I got to tell you. A little bit of everything. I have read about the bucolic upbringing you had in the North Woods, picking blueberries, skipping through the woods. Then there was a buffer in the fact that you went to Menominee for some stout schooling. But then you found yourself in Los Angeles doing graphic design, but you didn't like working on a computer, so that's my setup. Assuming there was a little bit of culture shock between Solon Springs and Los Angeles.
That's for sure. Yeah, Menominee, though, felt like a pretty big town. That was a good little introduction to traffic lights. And yeah, so going to Menominee was nice. I went to school for graphic design.
Yeah. You liked art as a high school student?
I did.
And
yeah,
as a kid?
Yeah, absolutely. Just, you know, grew up drawing nonstop. I think when I was getting ready to go to college, I didn't really know the difference between different art forms and practice in terms of what a profession would be like. And so graphic design felt like sort of natural in terms of finding something that I could do that was artistic and become employed.
That's always the thing when it comes to art.
Exactly. It's
the
trick, right?
You have to find a facet of it that's employable.
Yep.
Because a starving artist is not what you want to be.
It's not the best. Yeah. It's romantic in theory, but in practice is pretty hard. So, yeah, went to painting classes and drawing classes and really loved those. And, you know, now looking back, I realized that I was a student going to school for graphic design, wanting to be in studio art, doing drawing and painting. Oh, yeah, I knew that that was where my passions were. And now I realize the sort of perfect balance between graphic design and fine art is really illustration. Not really knowing, though, that that was a logical path either. I ended up graduating with graphic design as a degree, and my husband and I moved out to Los Angeles after graduating and started job hunting. And you know,
that was to help him pursue what he did, too.
Yeah, so we both went to college, you know, me going for graphic design, him going for what at the time was called multimedia design, so sort of digital design. Mm-hmm. But we both had our eyes on slightly different art forms by the time we graduated. Mm-hmm. We decided, all right, let's go to Los Angeles.
Go to Tinseltown.
Yep, see what kind of opportunities we could find. And while we were there, I was working graphic design day jobs. And I went to a book festival, and I came upon the Society of Illustrators booth and chatted with some illustrators. And it was just this appealing thing to see they were making a profession as illustrators. And so I started thinking about that as a possibility. The illustration that I was always doing sort of in secret on the side just leaned in the direction of children's book illustration.
Did you do that even at Stout? Were you able to do your fine art at Stout?
I did a little bit, and I realize now that I really tried to sneak it in wherever I could. And you know, going to a school where it's either graphic design or it's fine art, illustration wasn't really a part of the mix there.
Oh, okay.
And so it wasn't totally encouraged, but I think every once in a while I would do a project that leaned in that direction and a professor would say, this is really good. You should think about this. I think the idea started creeping in while I was at Stout. And when my first niece, Madeline, was born, I made a little book for her. That was my first rookie, like making all the mistakes of not the right number of pages, didn't research what a children's book should be like. It was just sort of a personal family gift.
Now, there is a quote in one of the reviews on the back of the dust cover of your new book, which we'll get to in a moment. You are said to have, quote, an intuitive knowledge of what the world looks like to a very small person, unquote. Is that the world that you visit before you dive into projects? You have to maintain that perspective.
Definitely, yeah. I love that quote. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's one of the biggest compliments I've ever gotten from a reviewer. And I think maybe what makes children's illustration such a natural fit for me as an artist is that I just still have very vivid visual memories of what childhood was like. Now I realize growing up in rural northern Wisconsin, it was a really special time and place because I grew up in this tiny town, lots of land to roam around. I lived surrounded by my grandparents and cousins, and so we just had a lot of space to play. I think drawing becoming the natural medium, it merges well with that clear memory of what childhood was like and felt like and how I experienced books when I read them as a kid.
You really made quite a splash with Miss Maple's Seeds. And we should point out that you're also an author. I mean, you don't just illustrate.
Yeah,
you have
it's
done.
True.
Yeah, you.
I'm
as
slowly
well. Did you
coming
write that
to
one?
Admit that. Yes.
You
yep,
wrote that
I
one
wrote
too.
Miss Maple's Seeds. Yeah.
So, well, there you go. And that was a big hit in children's literature. I can see two facets to that. Yes, it put your name in all caps in the genre, but it also set a pretty high bar for future projects.
It's so true. It was such a surprise. I was anticipating my first book to be kind of a quiet release. It's not a loud, flashy story. You know, it's about a tiny woman who collects seeds and takes care of them. And so it was interesting. 2 weeks after the book was out in 2013, it was over Twitter. Somebody said, "Congratulations on making the NYT list."
Oh, my.
You know, I thought it was a mistake.
Hmm. Or at least you knew what NYT stood for.
No.
I had
to look it up. Oh, I was like, and I thought that's what it was, but I was like, maybe it's something else. So I remember Googling, like, okay, NYT bestseller list. Like, that's the New York Times, right? And it was crazy. The next morning, my editor called and said, yes, it's true.
Oh, my.
It was so far above what I even thought was in the realm of possibility. I had to admit it wasn't just family and friends buying the book.
In the studio with Eliza Wheeler, an author and an illustrator well known, young enough to still have a great future in it. Her new book is called Home in the Woods, based on a true life adventure and real people, your grandmother and her incredible mother. This story makes for an almost unbelievable story for the children of today, many whose idea of hardship is the Wi-Fi going out for a few minutes. To them, it might feel like a fairy tale.
When I was little, my grandma talked a lot about what life was like for her when she was little. It was something that we play-acted, her stories that she talked about. I mean, even as a kid, it was the stuff of fairy tales to me or folk tales from her. How incredible it was that they did this hard thing and were homeless, essentially, and figured out how to survive up in northern Wisconsin and through the winters and basically hunting and fishing and picking berries. Yeah, it becomes more real, I think, with age.
The process of putting together a book, is it a series of mental images as the story unfolds, or do you write the full story first? And tell me about the differences, if there are any, between illustrating your own story and doing the same for someone else's.
Yeah, really good questions. When it comes to doing the writing and the illustrating, they're both very different skill sets. The illustrating is really what's come naturally the longest, and writing has been something that I've had to grow in terms of learning the craft. And so a lot of when I'm coming up with a story or developing a new story, I'm going back and forth. So I'm writing a manuscript, you know, just using Word, and then I'll go to the drawing table and I'll do sketches and what we call thumbnail sketches, 1-inch size sketches, to get the sense of the layout of the book and how it's going to flow and how the pages will work together. And a lot of times if I'm stuck on one, I'll switch to the other, and that'll really help me see it clearly. I think it's easier for me to see the book than it is for me to know what I'm going to say. If I can see what's happening on a page, then I feel like the words will come in terms of complementing. Because one of the most important things about illustrating and writing is you don't want to just repeat what's in the illustrations with the
they
writing.
They have to complement each other.
Exactly, yeah. So that's the big task, is how do I show something and tell another thing to create a more complex moment here.
And a lot of people may think that writing children's books is easy because there is not a lot of text. There doesn't have to be a lot of text.
Right.
But because there is so little text, it has to be good.
Exactly. Yeah. Every word has to count. Mm. Every word has to make sense. Mm. And there's also something much more similar to poetry, even though I've never written poetry. You know, poetry is much more about rhythm and word choice, and picture books are a lot like that, too. Oh, you asked the question about
the toughness between doing your own work and somebody else's.
Yeah, right. So I think the difference is just that it takes a lot longer to write it myself. Writing really gives me this deep connection to the story, and that can be what I love about illustrating what I've written. Sometimes it's a nice break to just get a manuscript in that's written by an author who's done it well, and I can just jump right into illustrating.
Kids are bombarded with so much stuff nowadays. My favorite books when I was a kid had to do with painting a picture of some place I wanted to be.
Yeah,
I wanted
absolutely.
To go.
Yeah,
and
me
that's
too.
What your woods thing is like.
Yes.
You sure wouldn't want to live like they had to live at the beginning, but
right.
once they had taken care of all of the bad stuff, you want to be there. And
yeah.
you doubt that there is a place like that. It's almost fantasy land. So.
Yeah, yeah. And it's neat because I think kids who grew up in rural Wisconsin or mm-hmm, the rural yeah. Midwest will relate to these locations because they'll be able to recognize it for themselves. But kids who live in the city or who live in different regions, they'll get a little taste of what life is like here. Mm-hmm. And that's a really neat thing.
Yeah. I imagine it might be a luxury to fall into a series like a Harry Potter or something like that because the characters can be recreated. Would you like to do a series or do you prefer the challenge of creating new characters?
Yeah, it just really depends on the story.
Okay.
For both Miss Maple Seeds and Home in the Woods, you know, people start suggesting follow-up stories, mm-hmm. and I could see that potentially working.
Well, Miss Maple could do a lot of stuff.
She could do a lot of stuff, yes.
For some reason, syrup comes to mind.
Yeah, right. Totally. I didn't think of that,
see,
but I'll credit you when that
yes,
happens.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think it depends on the story. I think with both Miss Maple and with Home in the Woods, those stories feel very finished to me. They feel complete from beginning to end.
And that's good. That's healthy. I like that answer because
yeah.
that means you're not looking for security. For
no.
You're looking for new challenges.
Right, right. And if I think a lot of authors create series, you know, because there are so many possibilities where
yes.
you can take characters. If I ever came upon a story that felt there's more to explore here,
mm-hmm.
I would definitely consider a series. For now, these both feel like very complete books to me.
You're brave. And they are complete because they're wonderful. Eliza Wheeler is the author and illustrator, and the newest book is Home in the Woods. She's from West and Northwest Wisconsin, folks, born and raised in Solon Springs. I bet you the people there and people here are awfully proud of you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Al.
That was my Wisconsin Public Radio colleague, Al Ross, speaking with Eliza Wheeler, a Solon Springs native and author-illustrator of the new children's book, Home in the Woods. Coming up, her life in Superior goes back more than a century. We celebrate with Isabel Tucson. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Isabel Tucson was born in Superior 102 years ago this month, on November 9, 1917. She grew up in the town, but has lived in the Iron Range of Minnesota and around the country. 2 weeks ago, Temple Israel of Duluth, where she's a congregant, celebrated her birthday and heard her share her stories.
Isabel and I all went out for brunch together the other day, and I did get to know Isabel, and I was inspired and delighted. And we asked Isabel if we could share some of what she told us with the group, and she said, yes, but just keep it clean. So I wanted to share a little bit because I do find it very inspiring. Isabel does exercises every morning, and she has a very busy social calendar. She plays cards, a game called Smear, and she says it's a good way to make extra money. And apparently she always wins. And she also plays Bungo, a dice game. And she goes to lunch with lots of friends, and she knows everyone in her apartment building and almost everybody in Superior. And she has one son, Barry, and a daughter-in-law, and two grandchildren, and four great-grandchildren. And she stays in touch with all of them. And so I just wanted to tell you a little bit about what we learned about her growing up. Both her parents were immigrants from Lithuania, and her father came alone at age 15, and age 19, he opened a grocery store, the People's Market, the only grocery store on the oldest one on Tower Avenue. And her family was very active in the conservative synagogue in Superior. And so now Deb and Dave are, I'm gonna turn it over to them and to Isabel so that we can ask a few questions of you to hear a little bit more.
Thanks a lot.
I love her.
Dave and Deb Carroll of Superior held a Q&A.
Thank you, Isabel, for giving us the opportunity to celebrate your birthday. Can you talk about what it was like to be a child in Superior, Duluth? What do you remember about being a child, like going to school and the neighbors like?
What do I remember about growing up here? It's always been a close, friendly town, Superior. And my dad had his grocery store on the main street, and I don't think I walked in there more than a half a dozen times because I was always afraid he might put me to work. Otherwise, it's like any other town you might grow up in what you're used to.
What did your grandfather do?
My grandfather was a tailor in Superior. And before that, he was a tailor for one of the czars in Russia.
Wow.
I thought that was interesting.
You mentioned something the other day I wanted to ask you about. When you were a young woman, you traveled and moved to Washington, D.C.
Right.
And I believe you said you traveled by yourself. That strikes me as a little unusual that a young woman at that point would be traveling by herself.
I always loved traveling, and I didn't wait for anybody else, so I just went.
Had your parents feel
about
that?
I went to Cuba just before they closed them.
Wow. So what were you doing in Washington, D.C.?
I worked for one of the departments. And I couldn't take the weather, so I transferred to Detroit. Couldn't take some of the people, so I transferred to Chicago. Couldn't stand the boss, I told him where to go when I went home.
So I don't want to take any more of your time or dig in, but I want you to know that it's worth that one-on-one conversation. You understand she knew both of your bridges' names. She knew John Blodnick was a family friend. She went to school with Dick Baum. So those aren't bridges. Those are people from my mother's life. So you put it in perspective. You're interested in World War II? My mother can tell you the story of how she turned down because her mother didn't want to see her to see Europe after the devastation, being a stenographer at the Nuremberg trials. That's something, if you're interested in, is worth a question sometime. Maybe just if you're interested in the evolution of healthcare. My mother had diphtheria. She has a huge scar from the forceps that yanked her out of her mother, being born at home in 1917. Before the women had a right to vote, the last election, some people that are very active in that election, my mother looks at me and goes, you know, I'm going to vote for the first time for all women in Wisconsin. It was a huge day for her. And if you're interested in an area of what's it like to be a woman who graduates in 1938 from Marquette University for dental hygiene, but there isn't a dentist that'll take her in because either wives didn't want her to work in the same office, or what the heck does she do here? She got a job in Ashland because she would also be willing to do the dentist's books. So I just want you to know it's worth the conversation.
That was Barry Tucson, son of Isabel Tucson, speaking at her birthday celebration at Temple Israel of Duluth. I took up his advice and did speak with her further, meeting Isabel at her Superior home a few days later. So, you know what I don't know is, what is your maiden name?
Teitch. T-I-T-C-H.
Okay. Are there any Teiches I should know?
No, there's no, none around anymore. Me. Born here in Superior. Of course, I didn't live here all the time. I went away to school, and then I lived in Washington, D.C. I lived in Detroit. I lived in Chicago. And then I came home.
Tell me about growing up in Superior.
It was a nice, safe place to grow up in. And at that time, we had quite a few Jewish families here, so that we didn't have to go to Duluth, you know, for all our friends. We had three synagogues here at one time. We had a lot of stores on Tower Avenue, and you could hardly walk Tower Avenue on Thursday nights. It was so crowded. And there used to be a popcorn stand and candy store that was open, and it was delicious just the smells to go by it. And Thursday night, that's when everybody came out. You couldn't find a parking spot on Tower Avenue. And the stores were open till 9.
Any particular?
A lot of restaurants. Every block had a restaurant. So you could stop at every block and you could get a cup of tea, a cup of coffee, anything you wanted. And we had a lot of dress shops. We had a lot of men's stores. Men's stores, not in department stores, but single stores.
It's a little bit different than it is now.
Very different.
Was this during Prohibition?
Oh, yeah.
Didn't you guys deliver for the moonshiners?
Not me.
No. Who did?
No, that was my cousin and her dad. The kids walked down the streets like they were carrying pop. Everybody knew they were doing that now. But it was very wide open, I guess. My dad never did anything like that. He had a grocery store on Main Street. Mm-hmm. And he looked down on that. Boy, he thought it was terrible.
You know, I always wondered, what did you do on Passover?
We used to have all our Passover dinners at my Zadie and Bubby's. And then all of us would sit around the big table. And my aunts were in the high school at that time, and I was eighth grade. And we'd put Love Story magazines in our lap and look down like we were being very pious.
But what I meant was the Passover service, you're supposed to have wine. So what did you do during the Prohibition? Did you have wine?
We all had wine. They made their own. My mother always made her own wine. And I didn't know anybody who didn't.
Now, your Zadie had to be, I don't suppose you know what year he was born, but he would be your grandfather, so he would be quite a bit older than you.
Oh, my grandpa was at least in his 60s, early 70s. And
so he would have been born sometime in the mid-19th century.
Well, in Europe.
Right.
So I don't know. They all came from Lithuania. You have old-timers, you know, in Superior. At that time, they used to be peddlers, most of them. And my grandpa had this tailor shop, and when the weather wasn't bad or if they didn't feel like going out, they all sat on chairs in my grandfather's tailor shop, which was right next door to a bar. And I remember one time I got a quarter and a half-gallon jar. I had to go over and buy some beer for them and went through the back door and I spilled some. And my grandpa said I was careless.
Wait, was this during Prohibition?
No, because the bar was there.
Oh, okay, good. So you didn't break any laws.
No, but it was funny because they all waited. When I got old enough to walk down to my grandpa's tailor shop, then they'd have me go to the bar and pick up My dad, grandpa had a big jar that they filled with beer, and then I'd carefully carry it back, and all the guys brought out their old glass, and it had beer. And then my grandpa would give me some money and go to so I could go and get some root beer.
So going to high school.
In high school, what was interesting, Jewish kids could not join the no sororities or fraternities. They never allowed us in there.
For college or for high school?
High school.
So there were sororities and fraternity.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, but not for you.
I could join the clubs like the swimming clubs or the school clubs, but I couldn't go into the school sororities or anything because Jewish kids weren't allowed. And that was in public school.
Right. So, but is that where you knew Richard Bong?
Richard Bong was in the study hall with me, but I never was in a class with him. And he was very, very quiet. So quiet you wouldn't know he was there. And we talked because I always talked. You wouldn't know he could have been on the farm yet because he never talked in school. He was real quiet. Yeah, nice guy, though.
And Blatnik, now that was a bit later, or?
Oh, Blatnik was, my father-in-law is the one that talked him to go into politics, and my father-in-law is the one that helped him win the range, which I think is interesting because he was a school teacher. And my father-in-law said he would make a good legislator. And then he offered my husband a job in Washington when he became one. But my father-in-law wouldn't allow my husband to take any kind of government job or any jobs like that. He always said, you can help people out, but that doesn't mean they have to pay you for it.
So your husband was from the range, I think you said from Chisholm, correct?
My husband was from Chisholm, Minnesota.
And what was his name?
Jake Toussaint.
After high school, you went to college where?
I went to Marquette University in Milwaukee. And then when I got through, my dad said my education wasn't complete. So then I went to business school.
But first you went, it was dental hygiene, correct?
First I went for dental hygiene. And like I said, after when I graduated, my dad said my education wasn't complete, so I went to business school and graduated from that too.
But the other problem, as I understand, was there weren't a whole bunch of people clamoring to hire you as a dental hygienist.
Dental hygienist, most of your dentists were afraid at that time to hire a dental hygienist. They were afraid you're going to take their business away from them. Rather than adding to their business, they were afraid you were going to take it away from them. It was terrible. It really was. I couldn't get a job in Duluth or Superior, but I got a job in Ashland from a far-seeing dentist who was ahead of his time. And so I became his dental hygienist, and he liked me so much. I had taken a business course, too. So then he asked me to do his private business, not the office. I started that, and then I got called to Washington, D.C., because I had taken the test for Washington, D.C. at that time because my girlfriend was nervous to take it alone. I got called. She never did get called. And so that sounded more fun than being a dental hygienist in a small town. So I quit and went to Washington, D.C. and took a job as a stenographer.
For the federal government?
Yes, for the federal government.
What department?
I was for a while in the Army.
Okay.
But I transferred to Detroit. And then I was there for a while. And I didn't particularly care for it, so I left that and went to Chicago and got an office job there until that fellow said if I wanted advance, but I had to go away with him for a week, and I told him where to go. So I went home.
That happened back then?
Oh, yeah. And you had nobody to run to talk to. So I just packed my bag and went home.
Was that the government or a private company?
He was government.
Oh. So you came back home, and then you worked at Oreck.
Oreck's.
Oreck was a department store at the
Oreck's time. Oreck's was a beautiful department store in Duluth. One of the nicest ones there. I was there 1 week, and they called me in the office and said they wanted to train me for a supervisor. They said I was a natural. So then I met my husband, and 6 weeks later, we got married. So then I went to Chisholm.
How long were you in Chisholm?
We were there till Barry was 2 years old. And then we moved to Superior because my dad talked my husband into working for him. He had a grocery store on the main street. And I didn't want to come back here. I want to stay. I like Chisholm. I like the small town. But we came here.
Well, Superior is not quite a big city.
No, but I don't believe in working for family. I think you do better when you work for somebody else.
And then that's been a few years, so what were some of the high points after you came back to Superior?
There wasn't many high points.
Well, we built a couple of bridges. Those are high.
Yeah. No, my husband died young, so. And then I got a job at the college.
At UWS or at?
Okay. UWS. Yeah. It was in the extension programs. Yeah, and I'd set up programs.
Those were pretty important because, this was out on the farms. You couldn't necessarily go to school.
Yeah. No. When I worked at the college and extension program, people could pick up a credit with maybe 4 weekends. And so I would set up programs. I'd talk teachers, professors into putting up special program. And they liked the $200 they made for a couple, days. And so it was easy. It was really easy.
I know people asked you this the other day at Temple, and they ask you all the time, I'm sure. To what do you attribute your health and your well-being?
Keeping busy. To me, I think that's the biggest secret of everything is keeping busy and get kind of nosy, know what's going on in the world. And as long as you keep your mind going, you're all right. I think that's the whole secret of staying busy.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It was fun that I just talking to you.
That was Isabel Tucson, born in Superior 102 years ago this month. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and Danielle Kading joins me in the studio. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
With this week's roundup of the regional news.
Yeah, the news this week on the national scene has been all about impeachment. And here in Wisconsin, Senator Ron Johnson is taking on the unusual and high-profile role of being one of President Donald Trump's most vocal supporters. At the same time, the Wisconsin Republican has emerged as a witness to key meetings and conversations at the heart of the ongoing impeachment inquiry. Johnson could also serve as a juror who will decide the president's fate. Despite his personal involvement and concerns he's raised about Trump's actions, the former plastics manufacturer has said he won't recuse himself if there's a Senate trial should the House impeach Trump. Johnson has questioned the integrity of witnesses and suggested impeachment is part of an effort to sabotage Trump. University of Missouri Law School professor Frank Bowman questions Johnson's behavior, but says he knows of no requirement that he should recuse himself. Support for the impeachment of President Donald Trump is slipping among Wisconsin voters. That's according to the latest Marquette Law School poll. 40% of voters surveyed believe Trump should be impeached and removed from office, while 53% oppose impeachment and removal. In October, 44% were in support and 51% opposed. Marquette's poll director, Charles Franklin, says these opinions are still subject to change.
As testimony goes on, does the public move in one direction or another as they hear and have a chance to absorb what that testimony is?
Support and opposition to impeachment were split along party lines. Franklin says one of the biggest changes over the last month is that Republicans have rallied around the president. The Wisconsin Attorney General is backing Michigan in its legal fight to shut down Enbridge's Line 5 pipeline running through the Straits of Mackinac that connects Lakes Michigan and Huron. Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel sued Enbridge in June. She said its longstanding easement agreement violates the public trust doctrine. The doctrine holds that states preserve natural resources for public use. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call says he and his counterparts from Minnesota and California are urging a Michigan court to reject Enbridge's position that federal law and the U.S. Coast Guard block state authority to protect natural resources.
If this position were accepted, that could undermine our ability to protect our natural resources.
An Enbridge spokesperson said in a statement that Line 5 has been operating safely for decades under the easement agreement, and there's nothing to support Michigan's position to shut it down. The Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa is also suing to shut down the pipeline on its reservation. Governor Tony Evers has signed into law a bipartisan proposal making it a felony to trespass or damage oil or gas pipelines in Wisconsin. Evers signed the measure on Wednesday despite complaints from opponents that it would violate free speech rights and disproportionately affect American Indians whose lands are often affected by pipeline projects. Evers says even though he signed the measure, he wanted to reaffirm that tribal nations, quote, deserve to have a voice in the policies and legislation that affect indigenous persons and our state, unquote. The new law builds upon a 2015 state law that made it a felony to intentionally trespass or cause damage to the property of an energy provider. The bill Evers signed expands the definition of energy provider to include oil and gas pipelines, renewable fuel, and chemical and water infrastructure. The Wisconsin measure has broad support from both Republican and Democratic lawmakers and labor and business groups. The former mayor of both Superior and Duluth was booked into the Douglas County Jail on a possible probation violation. The jail roster shows 63-year-old Herb Bergson was booked into the jail November 12th. Bergson was sentenced late last year to 1 year of supervision after crashing his car and leaving the scene of the accident in February 2018. KBJR-TV reports it's not clear how he allegedly violated his probation. Bergson was mayor of Duluth from 2004 to 2008 and Superior mayor from 1987 to 1995. And damaged Torah scrolls and prayer books that were salvaged from a Duluth synagogue fire in September have burned again in a garage fire. Officials of Adas Israel Synagogue say the items were being kept in the garage and were to be buried in keeping with Jewish tradition. The garage fire broke out Sunday in Duluth's Central Hillside. Fire officials say the garage fire is not suspicious, but the cause is under investigation. Former synagogue president Philip Scher tells WDIO-TV the damaged scrolls will still be buried. A homeless man admitted starting the fire that destroyed the 117-year-old synagogue. Matthew Amiot told police he tried to spit on the fire to put it out, but walked away when that didn't work. Police don't believe the synagogue fire was a hate crime. The Ashland Daily Press reports Ashland County will investigate a complaint filed against a county board member. The paper says neither the name of the board member or the accuser was disclosed. Ashland County's administrator says the matter is being sent to the county's executive committee for review, saying he was uncertain if the details of the matter would be made public. A meeting of the executive committee is expected to be held in the next several weeks. Flooding has caused more than $845 billion in damage across the United States since 2000, according to a report this week by Pew Charitable Trusts. But the research group says Wisconsin is among 13 cities and states that have reduced their vulnerability to flooding. The report highlights the state's Municipal Flood Control Grant Program. Matt Fuchs is with Pew's Flood Prepared Communities Project.
And we thought Wisconsin, with their program that has led to a significant number of buyout projects, is a really great example to include.
From 2002 to last year, the program bought and removed 140 structures from the floodplain. But the data shows communities are requesting more funding than what's available. Michelle Staff is the DNR's floodplain policy coordinator.
They don't have the resources, and so they need to reach out to other state or federal resources for funding.
The state has received more than $54 million in grant requests since 2002, more than two times the available funding. Fall storms have damaged a historic Fresnel lens at the Devil's Island Lighthouse on the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. Fresnel lenses use a series of prisms that refract light over vast distances that were used in many historic lighthouses, according to the park. Staff there reported this week that a section of the lens became dislodged and fell, shattering into multiple pieces. The lens was first installed at Devil's Island in 1901 and remained in use until 1989, when it was removed by the U.S. Coast Guard. But the lens was eventually returned 3 years later. Devil's Island was the only lighthouse in the park that still had its original Fresnel lens. Lakeshore staff have installed supports and padding to prevent further damage over the winter. The park will work with glass conservation experts and the local historic preservation community on a plan to repair the lens. And Wisconsin's nine-day gun deer season starts this Saturday. The season begins just before dawn and will run until just after sunset on December 1st. Hunters will be allowed to kill does in every county for the first time in a decade. It's a sign the herd is robust across the state. The Department of Natural Resources is encouraging hunters to dispose of carcasses in landfills or in trash bins the agency has placed around the state to slow the spread of chronic wasting disease. The department is also asking hunters to turn in deer heads for CWD testing as part of enhanced surveillance in 18 northern counties. Hunters in Barron, Bayfield, Burnett, Douglas, Polk, and Washburn counties are strongly encouraged to submit samples for testing at locations within those areas. An elk on a Burnett County farm tested positive for CWD this summer. Testing is free, and test results typically arrive within 2 weeks. Locations for sampling can be found on the DNR website at dnr.wi.gov. And that's a look back on some of the news of the week.
Thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
And here's one more news item about the news. For decades, Spa DeMaine was one of the nation's most prolific and influential Native American journalists. His News from Indian Country, a newspaper and later website and videocast, ran for more than 33 years. Late this summer, he published his last issue, and at 64, he's ready for his own next chapter. Rob Mentzer spent time with DeMaine on the Lacouture Reservation and brings us this report.
Paul DeMaine learned the value of independence in his first year as a journalist. It was the late 70s. He was working as both newspaper editor and communications director for the Lacouture tribe in northern Wisconsin. He'd been there for about a year when the FBI served search warrants on the chairman's office. The tribal chairman told him what to write in the press
Lacouture
release.
Tribe, blah, 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 blah. There are no FBI agents here. They are not confiscating documents. They are not serving search warrants.
He sent the press release.
And an hour later, I sent a second news story out describing how the police had arrived at 11:25 and served a search warrant on the tribal government and were surging.
And that, DeMaine says, is the difference between a public relations employee and a newspaper editor. DeMaine made a lousy public relations employee, but he became a great newspaper editor. DeMaine launched the News from Indian Country in 1986. It would grow to reach a national audience. In August, the newspaper published its last issue.
Let's take a look at the building.
The sign is down from the front of News from Indian Country. The inside is a mess.
You realize that we've already sent a lot of boxes and stuff.
The newspaper provided a digest of stories about indigenous communities from coast to coast and beyond.
I would have to read you know, 1,000 copies of the New York Times or the Washington Post in order to get the concentrated number of indigenous-related stories.
That's Patty Lowe, a longtime broadcast journalist in Wisconsin who now heads the Center for Native American and Indigenous Research at Northwestern University. She says the closure of the newspaper and its website is a blow.
It just makes me so, so sad.
Mark Trahant is editor of Indian Country Today. He says Demain's independence set him apart.
That vision, I think, was really extraordinary, where he saw this idea of being able to be independent by being private.
The biggest story Demain ever broke was also one that went squarely against what his audience wanted to hear. Working with two other Native reporters, in 2002, Demain published an investigation into radical Native American activist Leonard Peltier. Peltier had been convicted of killing two FBI agents on a South Dakota reservation in 1975. There are boxes and boxes of files from the investigation in Demain's office. He says Peltier had become a cause celeb in the Native community.
The idea that Peltier was an innocent man was almost a universal feeling at some point.
The journalists found multiple sources who had heard Peltier bragging about the killings. They uncovered evidence that a Native woman in Peltier's circle, Anna Mae Picto Aquash, may have been killed because she knew about it. The issue they published was a bombshell, spurring new investigation of Aquash's death. It also changed the way many people saw Peltier. Demain's Oneida name is Ska Bewis, the messenger. To him, that's always meant trying to find the truth.
I brought a message that nobody wanted to hear, but maybe nobody would listen to someone else.
Groups over here. This is all summer white oysters.
These days, Demain hunts mushrooms and taps maple trees on his land. It's not always easy to adjust to life without newspaper deadlines, but he's trying to take things as they come.
I've got food, shelter, people love me, I'm okay, let's get through today and live it to the best.
Demain is interested in food sovereignty, a movement to connect Native communities with traditional growing practices. He's inoculated a bunch of logs on his property with mushroom spawn. With any luck, they'll make for some tasty soups next spring. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And Rob Mentzer is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with an enduring Northland tradition. The annual Christmas City of the North Parade is today, and whether you're listening in the morning before it starts or during the festivities on our late broadcast, we'll put you in a mood with the official anthem sung by Merv Griffin.
Christmas City, wonderful city, all dressed up in snow and mistletoe. Christmas City, wonderful city, come this Christmas to the Christmas City I'll go. Up on hilltops, pick on an icicle, chew it while you slide the fun below. Down in Midtown, people are nicicle, come this Christmas to the Christmas City I'll go. I hear bells ringing, ding, dong, ding, dong, ding. I hear voices singing of a winter wonderland. Come along, you'll understand, Christmas City, gotta stay happy, make a smile ball. That's the kind of throw, Christmas City, wonderful city. Come this Christmas to the Christmas City, let's go.